Joining me now on the podcast is 2018 Harvard graduate and basketball alum Chris Egge. How are you doing today, Chris?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
Excellent, excellent. It's great to have you on. You obviously garnered a lot of attention last year for your powerful message as commencement orator for Harvard's graduation ceremony and the piece you authored for the Players Tribune about your Harvard experience and reflection on the fatal shooting of Michael Brown in Missouri, largely based on that commencement address. And also last year you were organizer for an event called No More Names, a benefit concert at Harvard for Campaign Zero, a campaign that advocates for police reform in this country. Now you're involved with a campaign called 10,000 Voices. It's generating a lot of social media and other buzz. Can you tell me a little bit about what that is and what the motive is there.
Yeah, so when I think about the 10,000 Voices campaign, kind of what the motive is there is it goes back to kind of a quote that, you know, I think about when I think about a lot of these issues. And, you know, it's actually a sad quote because it shouldn't be true, but often one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is merely a statistic. And, you know, there's a phenomenon known as the identifiable victim effect where, you know, as, you know, we look at numbers and statistics, we're able to create distance between us and, you know, the victims of, you know, the different atrocities that occur. But when we're able to attach a story to, you know, these different incidents, that's when people, you know, truly engage, that's when people truly fight for change, and that's when, you know, change happens. And, you know, the 10,000 Voices campaign is centered on that idea of the power of a story. And basically looking beyond, you know, the list of names that you know from the news, from social media, the hashtags, and really attaching stories to these people and, you know, us viewing them as people and the effect they've had on their communities. You know, and then the second layer of the 10,000 Voices campaign is the idea of, you know, youth activism and, you know, the Generation Z, the digitally native generation coming up. You know, this is just we're looking to build out kind of a platform for this generation to get involved in activism using some of the mediums that they're used to working with. So a big part of the 10,000 Voices campaign is that we're building out kind of an interactive map on our website that will, you know, will get launched on February 1st when people start posting. And when people post, you know, just to backtrack a little bit, on February 1st, it'll be kind of the official launch of the campaign, and, you know, the people who signed up will be posting, you know, Instagram videos, Twitter posts, Facebook posts, essentially highlighting the stories of one of the victims, and then hashtagging it with their name, hashtagging it with their location, hashtagging it with the hashtag remember their name. And then what we're doing on the technology side is we're building out, you know, an infrastructure to essentially, when you post, for example, here in New York, you know, where the Eric Garner incident happened, you would hashtag New York, hashtag Eric Garner, and then you'll go to our website, and on that website, there'll be a map. You can click on New York, and it'll look kind of like a Snapchat map where you can click on New York, Eric Garner's name will come up, and then all the people who've posted about Eric Garner, you'll be able to scroll through kind of a live updated feed of all those posts.
I see. How did this multifaceted campaign get started?
Yeah, how did it get started? Just through a lot of conversations with, you know, different people within you know, my network on campus. So essentially, it all kind of came out of the No More Names event I ran on campus last spring, and basically what that was. You know, benefit concert on campus. We had Vic Mensa come through and perform. We had Dr. Harry Edwards, who organized the 1968 Olympic protest, involved. And, you know, Jerry Nguyen, you know, donated. He shared, you know, know, what we're doing on this Instagram story. And, you know, I was really encouraged by what we were able to do in a short period of time. We raised around $7,000 in about a week and a half of actually fundraising. And, you know, I was impressed by what we were able to do. And, you know, I set out on essentially taking this to the next level. And, you know, part of the 10,000 Voices campaign is that it's kind of a launch pad for the broader organization of what No More Names will be in the future. And what that is we're looking to kind of create a platform again for Gen Z activism centered around issues of police brutality and criminal justice reform, where we're building awareness, we're raising funds, and, you know, we're serving as kind of like a bridge between, you know, young activists and, you know, previous generations of young activists and the work being done in their communities, young activists and, you know, pop culture influencers. Through essentially, we're planning in a concert series where we're going to be having events at all 8 Ivy Leagues. This you know, running from February through April, and you know, going into the future, you know, leveraging kind of concert/events across the country on different campuses to kind of build kind of a network, which you know, kind of leverages the idea of youth activism and collegiate activism, where how can we really build a bond between the community that's around these campuses that are quite often bubbles and, you know, the people around them, and trying to find a way to bridge that gap through these events, through this kind of No More Names platform, and, you know, through just working within the community and building bridges.
Yeah, it seems like social media has become a really powerful bubble-breaking tool in a sense in coordinating a lot of these kind of campaigns that are oriented toward a reform. And in particular, in this case, criminal justice reform, the issues of criminal justice reform and police brutality. In your view, do you feel like there's been meaningful progress within those issues in the last almost 5 years since you first got to Harvard?
Yeah, no, I think that's a loaded question. And when you know, I feel that there has been some progress, but not enough. You know, there's a lot of people on the ground doing tremendous work in terms of, you know, advancing different causes. But, you know, when you think about the issues, it's such a large issue. And when you think about what leads to incidents of police brutality, it's so much deeper than, you know, there's been great work in getting body cam issues. But, you know, often we just see body cams capture, end up just capturing issues of violence, right? They don't stop them. And, you know, the greater issue is kind of the systemic issue of racism and kind of the hierarchical structure that has been established in the United States, you know, through its very complicated and dangerous history that has, you know, relegated, you know, black and brown people to, you know, kind of what amounts to a second class citizenship in a country that, you know, quite frankly, they built. And how can you address some of these broader issues that then end up resulting in the symptom of police brutality? And you know, we're definitely making progress, but, you know, not enough is being made. And, you know, I feel a little bit with, you know, some of the current political climate, you know, some steps have actually, you know, been taken backwards. But in terms of how open people are about some of these underlying issues. So it's a complicated question with a lot of layers, and obviously we've made some progress, but I feel like we've taken steps back in other areas. Particularly, actually, when you think about social media as a tool for, you know, breaking bubbles, I also think it's a great tool for creating bubbles. And, you know, you see it with the fake news kind of media cycle where, you know, proliferating within both the left and the right is, you know, these fake accounts where you're sharing, you know, this content, and within the bubble, everybody is kind of just, there's kind of this echo effect, but people within the two bubbles aren't really interacting in the way that they should be.
It's a double-edged sword, I suppose. Absolutely, for sure. Do you think that sports, on the whole, is a positive vehicle or a platform for social change? And if so, why do you think that it is?
Yeah, I think sport is a prominent vehicle for social change on a few different levels. I think the first level is just on the community building level. One thing, you know, I had the privilege of attending a charity event at the Players Tribune this fall. And I forget the name of the organization, but essentially, you know, they bring together kids from different communities that, you know, typically are not working together. And, you know, actually, the greater communities at large are at war with each other. And, you know, those kids playing a basketball team together, and they, you know, they get to see and interact with people, you know, from the other side. And again, that's a way where you kind of get to this common theme of kind of just loving one another, caring for one another, and, you know, focusing more on our commonalities and on our differences, and just trying to care for each other's people. And I think sports provides a great platform for that. And then on the other hand, you know, in terms of sport, on a broader scale, in terms of, you know, when you think about some of the major sports leagues, and for example, what Colin Kaepernick did, I think, or what we've seen LeBron James do, I think sport often acts as a platform for the elevation of voices that have been marginalized over time. And, you know, I think that's part of what makes what Colin did tremendous, in the sense that, you know, there are a lot of people who share how he feels, but don't have the platform to say that. And, you know, sports offers an arena where, you know, we kind of idolize these athletes, and these athletes have these platforms, and a lot of these athletes come from these marginalized communities to kind of elevate the voices of the communities from which they come from.
Speaking of Colin Kaepernick, there was a pretty insightful article in the Crimson, Harvard's student newspaper, this week, that focused on Harvard basketball's exposure, as the article put it, to important social and political figures in our society, like Colin Kaepernick, most recently former President Jimmy Carter, former Secretary of Education Orrin Duncan comes to mind. Harvard has always seemed to be, under Coach Tommy Amaker, a very, at least from the outside looking in, a very socially conscious program, very intentionally so. What was it like being part of that program and getting to take part in some of that exposure?
Yeah, no, I think one way to speak to it is a funny story I like to tell. I remember my freshman year, I walked into the gym, and, you know, a senior on the team, Al Nesbitt, was in the gym, and he was playing around with, you know, an older man. I didn't quite recognize at first, and then, you know, they asked me if I wanted to play one-on-one with them, and I walk up, just take his hand, and it's Arnie Duncan. Like, this is the Secretary of Education, though. And, you know, having access to that kind of environment, obviously, is eye-opening, and that's, you know, not something that, you know, you typically, you get a lot of places where, you know, kids come from, and that was an eye-opening experience for me. And then just broader, in the broader discussion, Coach Amaker does a great job of building kind of a structure around cultural awareness in terms of, you know, asking us what we think about different topics, printing our articles for us to read. We have a faculty and fellowship program where, you know, we get to interact with different members of the faculty, and they speak to us about the work that they're doing. We get to ask them questions. We have dinner with them. You know, last year, we had a session with Cornell West, and, you know, he was just talking about, you know, soul and love and radical love. That was incredible. And then there's these once-in-a-lifetime opportunities, like with the team had this year, in terms of, you know, meeting President Carter, you know, going, they went to the MLK Memorial on Martin Luther King Day, different experiences like that, in terms of, you know, just from making sure that we're aware. Coach always uses the phrase, you know, do good and do well, right? And, you know, the first part of that is you did, and making sure that you give back to your community. So coach definitely places an emphasis on that, and it's great being part of a organization that has a culture like that, because it's eye-opening and honestly really, you know, led to a lot of the things that I'm doing now in terms of opening my eyes and, you know, making me feel like I can contribute.
Yeah, it's certainly enlightening to ponder the effort that must go into it from Coach Amaker's side of things, when, you know, you've got all the challenges and rigors of running a Division I basketball program with recruiting and all sorts of compliance, all sorts of challenges, and yet you have to, rather you don't have to, but obviously Coach Amaker feels there's an obligation to weave in, you know, the do good message and loop in different folks who can drive that point home and foster development to that end. So that's definitely an enlightening thing to view from the outside looking in. On the court, that was pretty cool on Monday to see Bryce Aiken back in game action.
Oh, yeah.
For the first time in 348 days, to be exact. What kind of teammate was Bryce, and why is that? Can you contextualize why that's such a big deal for the team in being back on the floor?
There's not enough to say about Bryce Aiken. That kid is a true warrior. I swear, I came to college, I thought I was the hardest worker. I had a policy, you know, you can't be outworked, you gotta do. Bryce, like, I couldn't even conceptualize how hard Bryce worked. So his work ethic, you know, the managers love him, but they have a love-hate relationship with him, because, you know, he's always in the gym, always getting up shots, you know, always working on his craft, and just that passion for the game, you know. Everybody sees it when it's showtime, and he's one of those guys that when it's showtime, you know, he'll take shots that, you know, not many people can make. But the reason he can make them is because he works like not many people work. So Bryce is just got that. He's got a confidence in him that is justified by the amount of work he puts into his craft. And I couldn't be happier to see him back on the court, because I know how much he loves the game. Honestly broke my heart to, you know, see him off the court for so long, but I'm glad that, you know, he's back playing the game that he loves and, you know, doing it at a high level. So, and he will continue to do so as long as he plays.
Yeah, it was very heartening to see him back on the court for sure. And let's hope that Seth Towns can join him there soon too. Obviously he's still working his way back. He's yeah. always, and again, all this is from the outside looking in, but he's always seemed to be a pretty not just a fantastic talent, but a very disciplined talent in the way that he seeks shots and creates his own offense within the context of the greater team offense. How would you contextualize what he brings and what elements he would bring back once he's able to return?
Yeah, no, Seth is the type of guy who can, you know, score whenever he wants to. He has so much in his arsenal. He's the type of guy you don't want to get caught defending. But what makes him special is that he is that guy, but he's also a great rebounder, a great defender, willing to not have to be the guy, willing to move the ball early in the clock and find his shot later. You know, looks to get his teammates involved. And anytime you have a guy who can score whenever they want to, but same with Bryce, can score whenever they want to, but their first priority is making sure the team is getting what they need. You know, I think that makes the team super special. You know, having Seth on the court at what, 6'8", 6'9", can shoot the three, rebound, defend, pass, dribble. You know, he can do it all on the court. So he's a game changer on the court. And then the team just feeds off his energy, man. When Seth hits the kind of double jab rock, we call it the steady rock, and kind of go to, or the half spin. You know, the team goes crazy and he gets the team going, gets the guys going, and you know, it makes you feel invincible when there's someone on your team no one can stop. So that's the kind of energy that Seth brings. And he does it in a cool, calm and collected way where, you know, he puts the team first.
Indeed, and you can see it watching the game for sure. To wrap up, you can learn more about the 10,000 Voices campaign at 10,000voices.nomorenames.co, and the hashtag, as you said, remember their names, starting February 1st, and you can reach out. Those who would like to organize the school's chapter, reach out to info@nomorenames.co. Is that right? And
someone will
reach out to you. Chris Eggie, thank you so very much for coming on the podcast and enlightening us.
Thank you for having me.